G'day team, welcome to another instalment of The U Project. Hello Tiffany Ann Cook.
Good morning, Harps.
Well, you've outdone yourself this week, haven't you?
Haven't I just?
When you said to me, I got the bloke who started Netflix, I went, no, you haven't. And you sent me his name and I actually went and Googled Mark because I thought she just got a bloke who knows the bloke who started Netflix. She didn't get the actual dude or one of the co-founders, but you did. You did. Yeah. So, hello, Mark. Thank you for thanks for joining us on the humble little U Project in the land down under.
Greg, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad, Tiff, that you managed to track me down.
How many Aussie podcasts have you done? Would this be number one or number 27?
Somewhere in between the two. Don't take this the wrong way, but I'll say yes to almost any Australian podcast. Come on, Mark.
Make me sound a little bit special.
No, it's true. But then again, I said no because I was booked for all of 2021, but Tiff talked me into it. It was hard to actually get me to say yes. No, but I don't know. I have this affection for Australia and its people, so I'm always happy. How about this? Disproportionate yeses for Australian podcasts rather than what comes in from the rest of the world.
How many? Well, we appreciate that. How many podcast chats would you do a week, give or take?
Oh, right now, as you probably know, I'm kind of working on promoting my own podcast. And so I'm doing a lot more than I might normally do. I'd say I'm probably doing 3 or 4 a week now.
That's good.
But listen, there's 1.8 million podcasts in the world? I've got a way to go. I'm chewing away at it slowly.
Well, you're doing all right. Well, we ranked from a global pool yesterday, we ranked second with our last episode. So we were very happy with that. So, but yeah, I think it's 1.8 or 1.9. I think you and I have probably got a way to go before we give Rogan any trouble.
Yeah, absolutely true. But listen, one thing, I don't know where I'm going to stack up when you actually release this, but I'm going to be somewhere in the 400th plus episode. I've just got to say, that's pretty impressive. I mean, I just released episode 8 today, so I've got a long way to go to have your consistency.
Yeah, well, I'm not very clever, but I'm really, really consistent and I'm really stubborn. But, you know, that's funny because I want to talk about that stuff. I heard you chatting with Tom Bilyeu on, Impact Theory, or I actually watched you. And, you know, when we're creating a business or an idea or developing a service or a brand or taking something from a cognitive, you know, construct, a potential something and turning it into a something, I heard you talking about, it's interesting because I thought, gee, I don't know how much Mark and I are going to have in common. Then I heard you talk and I went, almost everything in common, because I'm always talking about people's inability to start or lack of willingness to start. And then sometimes when we do start, depending on what the endeavor is, whether it's losing weight or changing a habit or behavior or building a brand or business, you know, invariably a lot of people stop not long after they started. But it seems that there's that being able to persevere and get uncomfortable and keep getting uncomfortable and being okay with, you know, less than ideal outcomes all the time is part of success as an entrepreneur and in business in general.
I completely agree. In fact, you know, when one of the most common questions people ask is, what are these common attributes that define successful entrepreneurs? And I go, it's not magic. It's not like you have to have a computer science degree or have some master's in business. The best entrepreneurs have a predisposition to action. You know, they start, they take the idea out of their head and figure out some way to collide it with reality. But because you're doing something that no one else has done before, usually, it's extremely unlikely you're going to get it right the first try. So you have to couple that predisposition to action with persistence, with the willingness to say, I'm going to keep on trying. I'm going to try different ways. It might take me 100 tries, but eventually I'm going to figure this out. It's absolutely, you got to start, but you also have to keep going.
And I think it's in the doing and the falling down and the getting up and the stuffing up and the, you know, light bulbs and the awareness. It's in the middle of the journey that the real education happens. And we talk about education and academia, you know, in Australia and the States, and, you know, it's held in very high regard, as it should be. But, you know, it's like, I know for me, where I've really developed and learned on a fundamental, oh, this is how people work, this is how business works, this is how human behavior goes, is away from academia. It's been in the middle of the process.
You know, it's a combination of the two. You're absolutely right. It's foolish to embark on something without getting some degree of insight into how it's been done well before.
Yeah.
But it's equally foolish to think that substitutes for doing it. I was going to use a golf or a tennis analogy, but I'll use a footy analogy. You know, we watch these guys play, and they do that thing where they're running down the field, and every, I don't know, 10, 20 meters, they have to bounce the ball. And of course, it's this oblong shape. And you can get someone to show you the right way to do it. You can watch a YouTube video on the right way to bounce a footy. But if you think that's going to help you bounce a footy, you're out of your mind. You have to go out and you've got to run laps around the field hundreds and hundreds of times before you can do that consistently. And it is absolutely the same thing with entrepreneurial skill. Sure, read up. Sure, take some classes, major in it in school, whatever floats your boat. But fundamentally, the way you're going to really learn how to do these things is to actually get out and do them. And that's the trick, is figure out some way to start applying these skills when you're young, or when you're in a low risk circumstance, or when you're not having your mortgage and your car payments and your kids' private school tuition dependent on it.
It's so, like, one, congratulations on giving an AFL or a footy, as you call it, which is an analogy. That's bloody beautiful metaphor slid in early in the show by the American. That's great. That's very adaptable. Pay attention, Tiff. That's called AQ. What was I going to say? Yeah, just that ability.
I really threw you with that one, didn't I?
I'm like, this dude's just talking about, That's amazing. Yep. But it is that willingness to be able to, you know, do. I mean, everyone starts as a white belt. I always say that. My listeners are sick of it. But what if it's business, or it's literally Brazilian jiu-jitsu, or it's bouncing a footy, running, or it's you know, starting at the gym for the first time. Everyone's a white belt, and you can't become a black belt without doing the work and doing the tests and enduring and surviving and getting hurt and getting uncomfortable and falling down and getting a blood nose. And you know, this is where resilience and strength and awareness and understanding and skill develops. Like, you didn't start Netflix as it is now. That was nothing like, I'm sure, the original idea or the genesis of from where it came.
Well, that's a somewhat different thing, which we should explore that as well, which is a critical piece of it. But in terms of the sense of learning to bounce the footy, is that Netflix was my sixth startup. I mean, I was in my late 30s. And in fact, I started learning these entrepreneurial skills when I was probably 6 or 7 years old, you know, when I was selling seeds door to door. So it's all these skills are not, it isn't like you go, I want to be an entrepreneur. All right, I had to learn how to go in and pitch a VC for $250,000 or $1 million, which is what you see them doing on Shark Tank or what you read about in the books or see in the movies. But if you try and have that be your very first attempt, of course you're going to fall flat in your face. You've got to start off gradually. You've got to start off with simpler things. You've got to scale your aspirations to your ability level at the beginning. And then, to jump into your other point, is you've got to recognize that what I think is going to work is wrong. That the more time I try and toss this idea around in my head because I don't want to start and fail, I've got to get it right. You are never going to start. You're never going to figure it out. You're just going to have this perfectly formed, beautiful idea in your head, which the minute it collides with reality is going to instantly tell you what a waste of time it was solving these problems in a vacuum.
I was listening earlier this morning, which was pretty early because it's only 7 o'clock now, but I was at the cafe, shout out to the Hamptons, drinking my coffee as I do. And I was watching you and Tom, and I was thinking, Something that had never dawned on me is that entrepreneurship, developing a business, creating something from nothing, it's actually quite a scientific process, which I'd never thought, because you come up with an idea or a hypothesis, a construct, then you try something, you create a plan around how you're going to test that, then you do something, then you get some data, then you evaluate the data, then you reassess, and then you go again. I mean, it's really, in some ways, it's a very analytical, scientific, methodical process.
Well, so says the PhD candidate over here. But
All right. There's a bit of creativity as well.
Thank you. That's exactly the point I was going to make, is that it's this combination, which is why I love it so much. It's a combination of art and science, because you have this tremendous ability to know down to the 14th decimal point whether the red envelope is better than the blue envelope. But it does not tell you for a second that, hey, you should be testing envelope color. And if you should be testing envelope color, it doesn't tell you why you should test red versus blue versus green versus pink. So it requires this combination of things. But fundamentally, you're right. There is a playbook. And the playbook is this process of test, repeat, learn, test, learn, repeat, test, learn, repeat. You know, and you alluded to that very beginning. And this was, you know, when we were even before we started Netflix, it certainly wasn't even Netflix, when my business partner, Reed Hastings, and I were trying to figure out what was the next business we were going to start. We had a million different crazy ideas. And anything we came up with was going to have to pass the test of, was there an element of reality to it? Mm. And the only way to figure that out was to collide it with reality. And so, for example, this is back in 1997, and this crazy idea that we had was not streaming video. The crazy idea was, can we do video rental by mail? Can we do what Blockbuster, which I believe they had in Australia as well.
Seems like a bad idea.
It was a terrible idea. And it was largely a terrible idea. One of the 600 reasons it was a terrible idea was that in 1997, video came on the VHS cassettes. I mean, Tiff, for those of you of your generation, you know, it's this big square plastic thing that a movie came on. I know that's hard to envision, but it certainly was not something you were going to be able to mail to somebody's house, which was part of the idea. But here's the entrepreneurial thing, is that one day Reed brought up that he'd heard about this technology called the DVD, which was this thin little flat piece of plastic that a movie could come on. Yeah. And so the idea came up with this, might actually now allow us to do video rental by mail, because mailing a piece of plastic, we could use the post office. So rather than saying, oh, what a great idea, and then begin imagining this future, we said, we've got to validate this. So quick, test, turn the car around. We were in the commuting to work when this idea popped into our heads, and turn the car around and immediately said, let's validate whether at least the fundamental premise that can I mail a disc to somebody and have it arrive at their house unbroken, and went to try and buy a DVD and couldn't find that, and decided to substitute a CD, a music CD, and mailed a CD to Reed's house, and found out in, you know, less than 24 hours that yes, indeed, you can mail a CD to someone and it gets to their house quickly and it gets to their house unbroken. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, for our purposes, it got there for the price of a postage stamp. And it's that process, one time after another, after another, after another, that ultimately leads you on this twisting, turning route that you never anticipated, hopefully, to the goal of any entrepreneur, which is the repeatable, scalable business model.
And when did you get kind of close to what Netflix is today? When were you starting to approach the model that it looks like now?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because in some ways it requires you to define what is Netflix today. And that was a cryptic answer, wasn't it? No, but we mentioned before about what a terrible idea this video rental by mail was. And it was, and everybody told me, was very helpfully telling me what a terrible idea it was.
Yeah.
You know, the book is called That'll Never Work, and the podcast is called That'll Never Work. It's because that was drilled into me over and over again, that this stupid idea will never work.
Such a good name for a podcast, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
We'll promote that anyway, but that is a great name.
But listen, it came from, you know, listen, you hear it enough. You go, okay, I'm going to use that one. But people said it was a bad idea for two reasons. And one was the Blockbuster. Mm. Why on earth is anybody going to rent by mail when you can throw a rock and hit a Blockbuster?
Yeah. Yeah.
The other one was that it's digital medium. Eventually people are going to be downloading or streaming. We weren't sure which. Mm. So they were both right. We knew that Blockbuster would be a big impediment. We also knew it was inevitable that people would be downloading or streaming. So this is the important part, which is that we knew we had to build a company which wasn't all about DVDs, because eventually that would go away. Mm. But we also could not build a business all about streaming because it was impossible. There was no content. The infrastructure wasn't there. Digital rights managements weren't robust enough. And so if we had come out with a streaming company, then we would have gone out of business. So we had to say, how do you position this that it works now, but that every piece of equity we build in our customer relationship, everything we learn about what they like and don't like, will be applicable when the world changes?
Yeah.
And so way back then, we decided this was not going to be a DVD company. It was not a streaming company. It was a company that was going to help you discover great stories. Mm. And this leads me full circle to your question. How has the business model changed? It's never changed.
Right.
On day one, it was, how do we help you discover great stories? And at the beginning, of course, you discovered great stories because we had every DVD available. And then eventually we helped you discover great stories by creating deep content and eventually helping you find more clever ways to discover it and then taste algorithms to predict it. And then as it got more convenient to find different ways to deliver it to you, we did that. But at the core, at the heart of Netflix, what drove every decision about what should we prioritize was help you discover great stories. And so that's never gone away. And people look at what's happening now with, of course, every content company in the world recognizing that this streaming business is kind of the way to consume content. But and Netflix has this huge lead. And it's not just because we've been streaming since 2007. So have, you know, what, 13, 14 years head start, but because we've been establishing this direct relationship with the customer founded on discovering great stories since 1998.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really hard thing for companies which have always delivered their content by sending a reel to someone who displays it in a darkened box for people they don't know.
Yeah. And the beauty of Netflix is, you know, there are billions of people who have a pre-existing relationship with Netflix and, you know what they're getting. And, you know, that makes a massive difference. Do you think that, I mean, I think some people perceive entrepreneurship as that it needs to be big and grand. It needs to be Netflix. It needs to be Nike. It needs to be whatever. But, you know, you can have a lawn mowing round and be entrepreneurial, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think one of the great disservices that we've all done in talking about entrepreneurship is glorifying it in some ways for the wrong reasons. That people think the reason to do this is to become rich and famous and wealthy, or it's like acting. The odds of that happening are infinitesimal. But if you're doing it for the excitement, if you're doing it for the fact that you get to do things different every day, you get to solve really interesting problems with really smart people, yeah, you can do that at any scale. You could do that with, how do I make my lawn mowing business more successful? How do I find new customers? How do I do this in a way that those other guys aren't doing it?
Yeah.
That's what motivates me. That's what I think is the secret sauce of entrepreneurship, not the scale. And by aspiring to only think that scale counts, it's like saying, there's a dumb analogy. You don't climb Everest by just climbing. You start. You start in the foothills, and it takes months.
Yeah.
And listen, starting a big company, you can't aspire to be Nike or Netflix. You can maybe if you are Apple or AT&T, and you've got maybe a couple $1 billion sitting around, then you have some incredibly talented people and thousands of them.
Yeah.
But no, you got to pick a niche. You got to pitch something small. You got to pick something that you can handle. You got to pick something that's within your realm. But if you're clever, you pick one that, if I get this right, the things I focused on will allow me to take the next step. And if I get that right, In other words, if I can mow my neighborhood's lawns correctly in this good way, there's two more neighborhoods next door. Wouldn't that be incredible? And now all of a sudden you're doing three neighborhoods. You go, gosh, I wonder if I could do this whole half the city if I did trucks and this. And then you go, maybe I could do a second city. And, you know, and then eventually you can become the nationwide lawn care service. But if you start out when you're mowing two people's lawns, you'll be going, oh, I need to invest in a fleet of trucks. And how do I move the fuel from here to there? And what a waste of time to solve those problems. Just mow one person's lawn better than the guy who was doing it before and focus on that for a while.
Yeah, I love that. I set up my first business, which was a screen printing business, obviously one person business when I was 19. And I set up my first gym in when I was 26, which clearly was 4 years ago. What are you laughing at? Hey, steady on Netflix, boy. Don't laugh too hard. But my main driver, and I didn't even think, oh, I'm becoming entrepreneurial or I'm going to develop this brand or business or service that's going to dominate. And we ended up, and we didn't, certainly not Netflix, but I had four gyms and I employed 500 trainers over 25 years. And we went quite well and we had a really good brand in the fitness industry. But my main driver, Mark, was I don't want a boss. I just didn't want to work for somebody. That was my motivation was, pursuant to your earlier comment, Your Honor, was I just want to work when I want to work and do what I want to do. I'm not lazy. I'm actually quite driven, but I don't want to spend half my day doing things that I hate or things that people want me to do that I actually think are inefficient. And so from when I was, you know, really early 20s, I spent my life trying to strategize around how I could not have a job for most of my life. And the last time I had a job was 31 years ago. So, and of course I wanted to make a few bucks and have a good lifestyle and all of that. But for me, it was very much about just being able to develop the things I wanted the way that I wanted.
Yeah. I call that the need to do, want to do ratio. And you never, in my opinion, it's really, really impossible to build a life where you can only do what you want. Yeah. Unless what you want to do is live in a van behind the 7-Eleven. But it,
shout out to our listeners who live in a van behind the 7-Eleven.
But for most people, everything is some combination of what I need to do and what I want to do. And if you can construct the life where most of it is what I want to do, then that you're doing pretty well. But, you know, it is for me that my motivations were not necessarily that. For me, it was more this compulsive thing that I couldn't help myself. I just was always seeing the flaws in the world that I would intuitively go, there's got to be a better way to do that. And then even worse, felt I had to rush in and do them. And luckily for me, I've always found that whole process fascinating of trying to solve these problems that no one's really been able to solve before. That's the fun part for me. And I'm incredibly fortunate that actually does pay a living wage. Otherwise, you know, that aforementioned van and 7-Eleven.
That could be you, dude.
Would have been a big part of my future and past.
Do you ever think about how you think? Do you have an awareness of the way that you perceive life and the world and the way that internal world of Mark intersects and interacts with your external world? Obviously, I'm fascinated with the way that people process life and situations. And, you know, there's an area of research called metacognition, which is essentially thinking about thinking. Do you ever think about how you think?
I do now, but only because I was forced to think about it. In other words, what happens is the lesson is, for example, when you want to teach somebody something, you sometimes have to go, I know I'm good at this,
right?
But how do I communicate what it is I'm actually good at? And it requires you to go back and really think, how do I break this down? What am I doing? And how am I, is what I'm doing different than what other people are doing who are maybe not successful at this? And so I'd have to, and so now, of course, I do recognize when I'm doing these things. But it took me a long time to begin going, What does distinguish, what are the common denominators that allow people who have crazy ideas eventually turn those into reality? Mm. What are those steps? When I, you know, I wrote the book, my wrote That Will Never Work, about those early years of Netflix. I wrote it 16 years after I left Netflix.
Wow.
And it took me that long because you sometimes need that distance to really recognize how much of this was what I did, how much of this was just lucky, how much of it was my contribution, and how much of it, what did I do wrong? What could I, and it's, that's a combination of being able to look back honestly, but also being able to think about it more clearly. So I there's some things I do think about as I'm doing them to discipline myself, but quite frankly, less on the entrepreneurial side and more on the balance side, more on how do I keep my life in balance? That I think about all the time. And I think about how I think about it. And the actual entrepreneurial stuff is less analytically driven.
So two things out of that for me. Thank you. That was great. I love that. See, the thing with you, listen to me telling you about you, Mark, listen, I'm going to tell you, I hope you're paying attention. But you probably do a lot of things organically, naturally, intuitively, instinctively, because you have, this is you, this is your nature, or this is, you know, you do a lot of stuff and have done a lot of stuff that way. And it's not that there's no strategy or thinking or planning, but as you said, then you arrive down the track and one day you're 50 or whatever, you're 60, and you're thinking about, oh, how do I break that down so I can teach someone? So, you know, like one of the things that I do is I train speakers to speak, because I corporate speaking, I do a lot of it. And then when I first started teaching them how to speak, I go, I don't even know how I do it, because there's no strategy. Like I invariably get up with no notes and talk for an hour or 2 hours, and I'm in flow and I love it and it's fun and there's no nerves. It's just joy and I create an experience, but I never planned that. So then when I had to teach someone how to replicate a version of that, it took me forever to figure out what I actually do. And maybe that's the challenge, is teaching others to, I guess, strategically do what you naturally do.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I think that the parallels are exactly the same, is that the entrepreneurial things, the just starting, the persistence, the continuing to try things and not falling in love with my ideas, the focus, the triage, those are all things that kind of came just naturally to me based on who I was. A lot of the cultural things that have gone into every company I've started that have kind of driven the Netflix culture came from not me designing them, but from just being who I am. And it is only after the fact, when you look back and you're trying to say, how do you begin to be helpful to pay it forward? How do you help give real advice, which is not just BS, to other entrepreneurs? Do you say, I've got to go figure this, really think through, what am I doing? How am I approaching this? And then the hard part is then, how do I coax someone into being able to do that? Mm. And sometimes that's tricky. The thing we've talked about multiple times today, which is that just starting, that taking that risk, you can say it all you want. You know, you can pretty it up on the Instagram quote panels all you want, but fundamentally it's against people's human nature to want to do something which has the risk of them looking stupid.
100%.
And I think that's a hard thing.
And we're enamored, especially in Australia, and I'm pretty sure it's in the States. I've been there a fair few times. We're enamored with the idea of personal growth and personal development. And we love quotes and we love mantras and we love posting things on the bathroom mirror and we love sunsets and puppies with nice quotes. But, you know, like the reality is that life and business and relationships and developing things is just, sometimes it sucks and it's messy and it's uncomfortable, it's unfamiliar, it's uncertain, it's hard, it's, you know, and sometimes it's glorious and awesome. But, you know, this is getting people to step out of their holding pattern or their Groundhog Day and into the unknown, the unfamiliar, the uncertain and the uncomfortable. That's the challenge. It's not that they don't have the ability, I don't think.
Yeah, it's a You're absolutely right. It's a critical piece of it. And in this more latter part of my life, where I've kind of realized my purpose is more trying to pay this forward, which is trying to unlock other people, to take everyone who has these great ideas or believes they're great ideas and wants to make them real, is I've realized that you can't just deliver the platitudes. You have to then teach by example, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give you just a quick example. You know, and again, I know we can talk about this a little bit later in the pod, but you know, I'm on the podcast I'm doing, I'm the That Will Never Work podcast. I'm not interviewing celebrity entrepreneurs. I'm not interviewing people. People do that way better than I do. What my podcast is sessions of me mentoring unknowns, early stage entrepreneurs who are stuck, who are trying to take their idea and get it out of their head, who are trying to turn their side hustle into a real business or trying to take their real business to the next level. But what I'm doing really is saying I could put on Instagram, the trick is, you know, to quickly, cheaply, and easily collide your idea with reality. Well, good for me. But what I'll do in the podcast is then walk someone through how in my particular circumstance do I think that through? How do I isolate the one component, which is really the puzzle, and figure out a clever way to try that? And hopefully by having people listen to me doing that, to walk someone through, to help them discover how to make that step. And not just with turning your idea to reality, but for all the other little principles of entrepreneurship. It's coaching people, letting people listen in, I hope, is the valuable piece of what I'm doing.
That is, as we would say in Australia, mate, that's a bloody brilliant idea, right? So that's, I mean, I love that because that is unique and that is you knowing that you have the ability to sit. You don't know what's coming. You don't know what they're going to say. There's no prep. You can't get ready. And I love the fact that, you know, in real time, you're sitting there and coaching somebody, and whoever you're coaching, you know, there's that other podcast that I like by Guy Raz called How I Built This. Have you been on there?
I haven't because I haven't. I've been interviewed by Guy before. He's amazing.
Yeah,
but you're right. It's a different thing.
I love the way that he deconstructs people's lives and journeys and businesses. And for me, I could be listening to the most random story that of somebody built some online lady selling shoes to the world. And I'm like, I see myself in that online shoe business. I don't know why, but it's not about the shoes or the online or the lady or necessarily, but just the challenges and the stories and the experiences and the lessons. And I think, you know, you doing that is an amazing, well, let's plug it now. Anyway, we'll do it anyway in our show notes, but the podcast is called That'll Never Work. How many episodes in are you? What's that, T?
It's That Will Never Work, not That'll Never Work. Oh, I've just subscribed.
That Will Never Work. How many shows deep are you?
We just released episode 8 today. So, and I'm only doing it, they only come out every 2 weeks for now to try and, as I learn this new medium.
Hey, listen to me, champ. Lift your game. Do one a week. Come on, get serious. Like, you're either in or out. Come on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so I think we are, once we get into the next season, which is soon, we'll accelerate a little bit. Hey, but, you know, I have an excuse, and this is kind of lame.
Do you, mate?
Not really, but I'm going to tell you what it is anyway. It's that my whole principle is that I don't wait until I understand something before I do it. Yeah. I go, I'll learn what I can, but then the way I'm going to learn is just by making my mistakes in public. And so I'm making my mistakes in public, which is that I'm basically learning not just how to do this, not just technically, but what's the right way to speak to people so these things actually come through and mean something to somebody. Then how do you promote them? How do you publish them? How do you engage with all these little pieces? Mm. And having a slower velocity allows me to learn from my mistakes at a reasonable pace without me having to be 7x24 on it. There's my excuse and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, you rationalize it however you want, champ. Yeah. I'm not buying it, but, you know, okay. Nice story and well articulated, but no.
Thank you.
Hey, it seems to me that for a lot of people, as we've spoken about a bit already, that the getting started part is the challenge. And it would think, so I think that probably that's around fear a lot. So For people that are listening to this, Mark, who are thinking, I've literally had an idea for 1, 2, 5, 10 years, or an intention, or I've had the same conversation about the same thing. And I know there's no magic formula, but just speak to us a bit about getting started if you're scared, and a way to, you know, not overcome that, but to, I don't think we ever overcome fear, but we navigate fear. What are your thoughts around that?
It is the single biggest impediment between people being successful entrepreneurs is not that they run out of money or not that they make a technical mistake. It's because they never start. And I've heard every single possible excuse for why I can't start. I can't raise money, can't find a co-founder, need my computer science degree, I have to graduate, whatever. I've heard them all.
Yep.
Can't quit my day job. What makes a great entrepreneur is not how good their ideas are. It really isn't. It's how clever they can be about figuring out quick and cheap and easy ways to try them. And so in the interest, let me give you an example of what I mean by how to break that model, because the way to do it is to figure out, I do not need to do all the things I think. I do not need to raise money. I don't need to build an app. I don't need to hire people. I don't need to quit my job. All right, here's an example. This is a young woman. She was still in university. I still do. And I did university students. And she goes, Mark, I have this great idea. It's going to be peer-to-peer clothing rental. Basically, I have a closet full of clothes I never wear. I know all my friends do. It'd be great to be able to borrow everyone's clothes and we could do that. And I go, oh, great idea, maybe. And she goes, what's the problem? And she goes, well, I need to raise money because I need to build an app and I need to hire someone to help me code this and blah, blah, blah. And I go, whoa. Let's stop right there. I go, do you have a piece of paper? And she goes, yes, of course, piece of paper. Guys, you do have a Sharpie, you know, the magic marker. She goes, yeah. And I go, okay, write in the paper, want to borrow my clothes? Please knock. And I want you to tape that to your dorm room door right now. And we're going to find out in the next 24 hours, a fundamental piece of your idea, which is, does anybody care? And if nobody knocks, well, you've learned something really valuable right there. And you learned it with a piece of paper and a magic marker, and you learned it right now. But let's say someone knocks, that's fantastic. Then you're gonna learn about problems with, well, they're a different size, or they didn't like anything. Well, then you've learned that. But what if they do and they take things? Now you're gonna learn how you feel when your favorite blouse comes back stained or torn. Or you're gonna learn about, oh, I never factor in the cost that everything's gotta go to the dry cleaner. Or. You're gonna begin that process of discovery about whether your idea is a good one or not. And you're going to do that by having collided it with reality. Now, this is not repeatable. This is not scalable. You can't do everything using 3x5 cards out of your dorm room, but you sure as hell can do that for the next few months.
Yeah.
And then you're going to know. And then rather than when you're trying to convince someone to join you or loan you money, it's not going to be, imagine if you will, it's going to be, oh my gosh, I'm going out of my mind. I'm processing 630 rentals every single weekend and I'm doing it all with 3x5 cards. And I need to figure out a way to automate this. And I need to figure out a way to, that's powerful. That's compelling. And you've learned that your idea is a good one or not. And most likely though, those things I just described, you're going to bump into something you didn't expect, you didn't discover. Mm-hmm. And then comes the persistence part. You'll go, wow, no one knocked. Well, what are you going to do about it? Wow, the stuff's coming back stained and or torn. What am I going to do about it? How am I going to modify this that it might actually work? So when someone is stuck, I'm going, if you're stuck because you can't envision, how am I going to build an app? And how am I going to leave my job to do this when I have car payments? Or you're not. You're going to do things quickly and cheaply and easily on the side, in your spare time, in a way that if it doesn't work, figuratively, what you've lost is a piece of paper and some tape because you put it in your dorm room and it didn't work, or whatever it takes to try this. And I can give you dozens of examples of every time someone says, I have this idea, there's no way for me to validate this idea other than actually doing it. And I go, you're wrong. There's always a way to validate your idea without actually doing it.
I love that. In I started in the fitness industry over here in 82, and in 86, so 35 years ago, I started training my first client one-on-one, as in personal training, and there were no trainers. And I remember thinking, oh, this is handy, because this guy's paying me $100 a week for three workouts, so $33-ish an hour, which for me was like $1 million. And I think my hourly rate on the gym floor was $10 or $11. And originally I thought, oh, well, this is great. This is an extra $100 a week, which essentially improves my wage by 20% or something. And then I got another guy, and I had two guys paying. I'm like, wow, this could be a thing. And one of my challenge, and it just kind of expanded, like it was almost an accidental business. I just happened to be not bad at training people and not bad at being cheeky and creating, developing rapport and communicating. And, you know, the two or three skills that I had collided and it turned into this thing. But I remember initially, Mark, feeling almost guilty that I was making, for me, amazing money back then. And I almost, I probably still a bit of this to the day. I felt unworthy and I felt somewhat fraudulent because I thought, well, no, my default setting was I'm worth $10 or $11 or $12 an hour. That was my default, cognitive default setting, for whatever reason. And then when I started to make more money, and then I got busier, and in the next 12 months, it went somewhat crazy where I had a waiting list because I was actually managing a gym at the same time. I was 23. So I had a 50-hour a week full-time management role managing a gym. Plus I had this side hustle, which was becoming bigger than the main job. And it's, you know, for my biggest problem was, and probably still is, might not seem like it, but my own bullshit, you know, my own confidence, like constantly fighting that. And I feel like a lot of people have this, Mark, where they know that they've got potential and ability, but they're that feeling of being a fraud or not good enough, that's an ever-present challenge. Has that ever existed for you?
Oh, of course. Especially when you're doing things without really thinking about them. You go, why is someone asking me this question? Why are they looking to me? So absolutely. But, you know, I'd argue, and I'll use your specific example. You didn't sit there at your 50-hour a week management job dreaming and going, gosh, wouldn't it be cool if I had this individual training business? Boy, it could make me five times the money, and I need my own gym, and I'll have to get my own equipment. Then you're going, I can't do that.
Yeah.
That's not how you did it. You just had one guy on the side.
Yeah.
And whoa, that he's willing to pay me this. That gave you the confidence to go, now I can do three guys and then five. And then pretty soon you're going, wow, I think there's enough business here that I can quit my day job and do this full time. And it does not require this, I'm a Superman leap. Mm. It requires, it's actually working. Mm. But I agree. I still have those feelings of, even though I'll come onto a show like this and I'll go, wait, why are you talking to me? I'm like, nobody.
Come on.
I mean, it's a cognitive dissonance thing, because of course, you know, I can tell myself my own success, and I can tell myself you've won the lottery multiple times, and that's more than just odds. Mm. And so I go, I've got it. I guess I know something, but still I don't see myself that way. It's a very odd, very odd feeling.
I think those things that I've spoken about this a lot, the ability that we have to consciously or, you know, intellectually understand something. Oh, well, I must be quite good at what I do. I built Netflix and a bunch of other things, and I've succeeded repeatedly, and I've fallen down and gotten back up, but you know, your track record is amazing. But that knowledge and that intellect can coexist with the feeling of I'm not that special, you know, and that's for me ever present.
And it is for me too. And in fact, It's interesting that you talk about the Guy Raz show before, the How I Built This, because one of the things that's wonderful about that is him showing that a lot of these people who built very, very reputable, huge companies had all kinds of failures and all kinds of moments where this almost never worked. And in many ways, the reason that I wanted to write the That Will Never Work book was to show people that I am not a Superman, that I made a lot of mistakes. There was a whole bunch of times when this almost didn't work, that there was other ingredients that went into making it successful, that it's not all. It's not one of those books where every chapter is chapter one, look how amazing I am. And number two is look what a spectacular decision I did. And number three is look how clever I was. not the case at all. You know, you got to warts and all.
Oh dear. You must, do you get, you probably don't spend that. Do you spend any time looking at social media or do you avoid that?
I avoid it, but it's weird because I participate in it. And so it's like, what do they say? Never get high in your own supply, I guess is the answer. Yeah. So I need to constantly be really careful. And man, I can feel it happening. It's engineered to be addictive. And it's, whether you're a content creator or a content consumer, it's no different. You watch the follower counts go up and you just want to keep hitting refresh and hitting the little lever and getting the little mouse pellet. And it's a hard one.
I'm already thinking about how many people are going to listen to this conversation because we've got you. I'm excited. I'm all about the numbers, bro. I'm a total addict.
Yeah, it's okay. So my weakness is TikTok.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you, 12 years old? What's going on?
I don't know what it is. It's just something about the fact I'll sit there and just kind of hit the lever over and over again. But at least I can recognize, you know.
You're like those rats in that study with the, you know, they had the cocaine water up one end or whatever it was. Do you remember that study?
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's what I mean. It's like I tell myself it's okay. You can handle this. You know when to stop.
Yeah. How's that working out for you? Hey, just quickly, we know you got to go and we really love talking to you and know that you didn't need to do this. So we appreciate it. How you spoke momentarily about life balance, you know, and you're still obviously still young enough to work and young enough to produce and create and keep learning and adapting and evolving and all those cool things. But what does life balance look like for you? You know, how much work, how much non-work, how much socializing? I don't know. How does that work for you?
I think it's one of the luckiest things for me was that I figured a lot of those things out really early. I mean, early enough that I could do something about it. Probably in my late 20s, early 30s, I was already starting to recognize what I needed to create what I felt was this full life. And it's those components haven't really changed since then. And there's three of them. So for me, it's almost equal thirds. Certainly I love the work. Obviously I'm in a position, I don't need to do it for a living anymore. But the things that motivated me to become an entrepreneur have never gone away, regardless of the economic success I've had from some of them, which is that I love that process of solving problems. I love sitting on the table with smart people. And I still get to do that. I get to do it now more as a mentor. I get to do it now with the podcast and the other ways that I try and pay it forward. But I try and make sure I limit that to about a third of a week. And I really pay a lot of attention to the ratio between want to do and need to do. Listen, when you have team people who are helping you, you have to do a lot of stuff that you may not be want to do, but you want to make sure you don't lose sight of the things you want to do. And that's in the work environment. So that's a big piece of it. That's one part. But again, I limit it, which is one of the reasons why Tiff had to fight so hard to find a time to put us together, is because I only do it for 2 days a week.
Yeah.
And I crunch everything into those 2 days, which means it's hard. Okay. Number two is I'm married. I've been married for a long time. I have three kids. And I vowed a long, long time ago that I did not want to be an entrepreneur who was on their sixth company, but also on their sixth wife.
Yeah.
And more importantly, recognized in my late 20s that that would not happen if the family and wife were the afterthoughts. Those were the things that I got to after I focused on the business, that I had to make that a big rock in my life, big enough that everything else fit around it.
Mm.
And that's never stopped happening. And so that whole piece of my wife, my family, my friends, having time for all of them is a big piece of it. So that's another third. But there's a third piece, which is that I'm really passionate about the outdoors, about, this is a very Australian thing, but just being outside. You know, I surf, I ski, I mountain bike, I climb, I kayak. I anything that involves being outdoors with the potential chance of hospitalization, count me in. And unfortunately, though, I did not pick a hobby like stamp collecting or chess. I picked something that requires frequently getting on three planes in a row to go to some place way up in northern Alaska and then spend 10 days kayaking this wilderness river. And you cannot fit that in between your 11 o'clock conference call and your 2 o'clock meeting. You have to, if you want those things to happen, you have to make sure you construct a life carefully to let that happen. So when I said to your earlier question, do I think about how I think? I'm always evaluating that. I evaluate at the end of every week. I evaluate every month. I evaluate at the end of every year, which is how did I do? If I feel it getting out of balance, either getting out of balance because I'm working too much and it's taking away, someone goes, let's go for a mountain bike ride and I can't go, I ask myself, why? Am I prioritizing anything incorrectly here? Have I structured something in a way that's preventing this from happening? And I have to work. That does not come as naturally to me as the entrepreneurship stuff.
But so interesting.
The funny thing, and this is the, you know, we ruminated about success and about how I feel that so many entrepreneurs are motivated by these wrong things. But I've certainly had success from this one perspective, which is I have had, you know, I've started starting seven companies and, you know, two of them are multi-billion dollar companies. So unbelievably wonderful and lucky. But the thing that I'm proudest of is not that. The thing I'm proudest of is doing those things while staying married, while growing up with my kids knowing me and liking me, I hope, and having a chance to do the things that make me whole, which is, you know, the backcountry skiing and all those things. That's success.
How dare you be so successful and balanced and make all that dough and be a good human being and stayed married. I think it was 1987 you got married, I read. 34 years, three kids, geology undergrad degrees, Tiff. What's that about? And he didn't bloody do anything with rocks. What's that about?
Yeah.
He climbs them.
I climb them. Well, it is. It's basically that in school, I would see that the geology majors, and they'd all be coming back from this field trip. They'd all be piling out of the van and they'd spent the whole weekend or a whole couple of days up in some incredibly beautiful mountain thing. And I went, that sounds like the major for me. But it was always about that. I had zero interest. Not, there's anything wrong with it in being a petrochemical engineer or being a oil field worker or something like that. No, thank you.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you. I could ask you so many, I've got so many more things I want to talk about, but I realize I can't. So Tiff will book in for 2026 for our second conversation. When I think that's your next opening.
Every 400 of your episodes, book me in. We'll just do it as a matter of course, okay?
You've just tripled my workload. He's going to want to roll out 27 a week now.
Exactly right. You get on you bring your A game, Tiff. Hey, Mark, we appreciate you. So tell people, just once again, for the people who have been slumbering through this, the name of the podcast, the name of the book, and where they can connect with you and so on.
So certainly the book is That Will Never Work, as is the podcast That Will Never Work. And both of them are available wherever you find whatever you're looking for. And of course, for all things Mark Randolph, if you don't have the time span, the attention span for a 30-minute podcast, you can get everything sliced and diced into whatever size nuggets you can digest at markrandolph.com or all the various social media outlets that I am duty bound to keep posting content to.
Of course you are, you bloody champion. Mate, thank you so much. If you can stay on the call after we sign off, Thanks for being on the show, mate.
Craig, a pleasure being with you. This was really fun. And Tiff, thank you for coordinating all this. Both of us know none of this would happen without you.
Thank you.
That's exactly right. Thanks, Tiff.
Thanks, Harps.
Love your guts, everyone. See you next time.